Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's Island Testa. This is our first show for January 2016. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. Thank you guys very much for listening. We're going to start off the new year with a really interesting topic and something that we've sort of touched on a few times over the past couple of years. And that's the idea that Walt Disney World, in addition to being an entertainment complex, a vast entertainment complex, is also a city. And like normal cities, Walt Disney World has some basic functions that it has to provide to its guests. And among these are transportation, food, lodging, and security. And Jim actually had a great idea to talk about this. We'll talk about security and transportation today. And then we'll segue into the other ones. But it's a really unique look at how Disney does this thing. So in order to do this, let's bring in Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Well, not bad. A happy new year to you, Len.
Our normal high temperatures that we're getting at the end of December have been replaced by torrential rains at this point. And actually, we're getting lightning storms in Greensboro as we're recording this. So that's a typical December, sure.
Any consolation, we got our first snow of the season yesterday, and boy, it more than made up for it. It was heavy, nasty stuff. So the joy of shoveling.
But I'm expecting frogs here shortly.
I am sorry for your tomatoes then. So.
I know. All right. So let's talk about security in Walt Disney World. You had an interesting perspective here on the size of Walt Disney World compared to other cities, right?
So we're using the 2014 numbers. All right. But we start off with the fact that this is a resort that has 62,000 cast members working on it at any one time. And then average day at the Magic Kingdom, you've got 53,000 people. We jump over to Epcot. There's 31,000. Animal Kingdom and Disney Hollywood Studios, that's 28,000, actually at both parks, 28,000 in Animal Kingdom, 28,000 Disney Hollywood Studios. That correlate with your unofficial guide numbers? Or?
Yeah, it sounds about right. So you got about 140,000 people.
Yeah, and then you factor in, you've got 6,000 people a day on average at Typhoon Lagoon, 5,500 at Blizzard Beach. So yeah, you're looking at 150,000 people without even breaking a sweat. And that's, on average, not your holiday crowds, that sort of thing.
You have to factor in the employees.
Right.
The people who are in the hotels who don't go to the parks.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, given all the money that's being spent on Disney Springs, the people are supposed to go over there. So you've got, on average, 250,000 people. And with holiday attendance levels, let's bump that up to say, 300,000. To put that in perspective, folks, that's the Trenton, New Jersey has 268,000 residents, and Corpus Christi, Texas has 293,000. So on average, we're talking about a pretty good size American city's worth of people on property at any one time.
We're going to talk about the crime statistics in Trenton now, are we?
We don't want to do that. Trust me, I just looked and
Cory Booker's going to call us at the end of this, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to avoid that as we're just talking size at this point. So what do you think? A city that puts the incident that happened on Christmas Day over at Disney Springs kind of in an interesting perspective.
So let me set up this incident for you. So everyone knows a couple months ago there were terrorist attacks in Paris at a concert at several public venues, actually. And, mm-hmm. and since then, Disney World and Disneyland, of course, being large, well-known, prominent public spaces. People have wondered whether something like that could happen here. Disney responded possibly to that by testing out, I guess, metal detectors now. There's also a guy that brought a gun into the Magic Kingdom or tried to bring a gun in the Magic Kingdom. So Disney started testing some metal detectors, and the idea is that, I guess, sometime after Christmas, the metal detectors will come in. So against that backdrop of terrorist attacks and public events of people bringing guns into the theme parks, we come up to this event on Christmas Day, right?
Yeah, and let's not forget that in between Paris and the idiot who tried to bring the gun into the kingdom, we had San Bernardino. And in fact, I was talking with a manager at the Magic Kingdom a day or so ago, and one of the reasons that Disney has not put metal detectors at the parks up until this point is that the fear of reminding people of the outside world. They wanted to just get across the message that we have our security in place, we do the bag checks, you're secure here. Right. You don't have to worry about the outside world. But the Disney World management, they don't think it's a coincidence that these test metal detectors went in on property prior to the holiday, mm-hmm. and then they had this panic at Disney Springs within the same window. They think, in a weird sort of way, this reminded people of what happened to the outside world.
Yeah, I get it. That's a really interesting way of looking at that particular thing. Let's go back to the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why Walt wanted all of this property mm-hmm. is to insulate himself from the outside world.
That's it, exactly.
And the metal detectors bring in the outside world when we've just bought 28,000 acres to keep it away. Okay, all right, so go ahead.
Now that we live in this culture where people are carrying a camera and a communication device in their hand at all times, mm-hmm. you really can't keep the outside world at bay, which brings us to what happened that evening at Bongo's. You know, honestly, Glenn, you could have cleared up this problem with one conversation. Luis Antonio Andreas Reyes, the 70-year-old gentleman, he's from Georgetown, Florida, brings his family to Disney World on Christmas Day, and he wants to have dinner. So they go over to Disney Springs, and they go to Bongo's, and it takes an hour to get a table.
I mean, Christmas Day, down to Disney Springs. Okay, sure. So far, the only thing I'm questioning about his behavior is the choice of Bongo's, but...
Okay. All right, so they're in Bongo's. They end up seated upstairs, outside balcony, okay. and they sit there for an hour and a half, because the kitchen is overwhelmed.
Not entirely unknown at Bongo's again, I'm just saying.
Luis, all right, come with me. We're going someplace else. Or why are you here? Why did you come here? So he starts to get irate. Manager comes over, tries to explain, I'm sorry, it's Christmas Day. We have record crowds. The kitchen's overwhelmed. We will get to you as soon as we can. This isn't good enough. All right, so Luis stands up. A shoving match begins. Luis's contact can't really be forgiven here. I mean, a lot of us have been at Disney World and stood in a line. We never at one time felt the need to punch out somebody. This is what he does. And another cast member comes over, and at some point, the table gets knocked over with a loud crack. So you've got people downstairs and people walking by. This is the part of the story I don't entirely understand, because you've been over to the West Side. You've been over, you know the area music. You know how loud that is.
Yeah, Bongo's in general, you couldn't hear a table crashing above the salsa music.
Supposedly, the people down on the street on the West Side, all they can hear is an argument escalating on the second floor outdoor balcony of the restaurant, and then they hear a crack, and somebody says, gun. There were people who actually got hurt because of the crowds that just rushed for the parking structure to get to their cars to escape. Nobody was killed. Luis was arrested for assault, for grabbing, I guess he grabbed the manager's arms hard enough that he left a mark. And then there were a couple of people who were knocked down and that sort of thing.
Knocked down in the rush to get away from Bongo's?
Yeah. We live in this social media age. Somebody shouted gun. The stores and restaurants around went into security mode. They locked down. And so people are like, active shooter situation at Disney Springs. And it was one of these things where Orange County, within a half hour, they were on site in seconds, but within a half hour, we're actively, no active shooter situation, no gun, trying to get that message out. But turning that narrative around took a while. The people who were on the ground who heard, from people say, shooter, I don't necessarily think it's irresponsible of them to get online and say that this is what they're saying. But this story went rogue real fast in the wrong direction.
I mean, on Twitter, it went from hearing something about security incident mm-hmm. to possible active shooter to just a fist fight in a matter of like 30 minutes.
If we're talking about Walt Disney World as a city where bad things happen, I mean,
let's put it this way. If this had happened in Trenton, we would have glanced at it in our Google News feed, along with, whatever Adele's doing for Christmas Day.
There you go. Like there have been genuinely scary things that happen inside the parks. All right. Now, take, for example, this is a Flash 4500.
We're not talking about the burritos that they used to serve at...
No, we're talking about something a little bit more explosive, Len.
Okay.
Flash 4500 message from February 4th, 1972. The park has been open for less than 2 months at this point. This is something they actually gave out to the cast members. Like, you need to know about this. On Thursday, February 3rd, Walt Disney World received several calls from an unidentified male threatening an explosion and seeking money. During the evening, after the regular closing hours of the Magic Kingdom theme park, the caller said he had placed a bomb. Within a few minutes, employees located a suspicious-looking case in a non-public area in Frontierland.
What? I've never heard this story.
The case was then turned over to law enforcement. There was no involvement with guests. They didn't have any information at this time whether or not there were actual explosives in the thing. Disney actually makes an attempt to meet the guy's demands. They try to do a money drop, but nobody came to collect the money.
And, wow. And this is 72.
72. Okay, so jump ahead to June. This has finally made it in the court system, and oh my God, what a story. Okay, it turns out it's a disgruntled cast member. He decided he was going to make some money off of the company by pretending to be a mad bomber. So he asked for $90,000. The gentleman who did this, his name was Robert Harakara. It's a 23-year-old. His father is Joseph Hara, the president of Tupperware Home Products.
So not exactly needing the money?
Not exactly needing the money, but the details as they start to come out, they go to the employees when they get this phone call. You know, they get a phone call and say, if you don't think I can blow the place up, just go look in the utility shed. And so sure enough, they go to this utility shed in the Frontierland area. It's a time bomb. It's literally a time bomb. And it's 3 hours before it's set to explode. And
is it encased in Tupperware?
That would have been nice. But no, honestly, this stuff happened, folks. But the difference was that there wasn't social media. There wasn't a Twitter. There wasn't a Facebook. For example, we jump ahead 20 years. It's September of 1992, and 37-year-old Alan Ferris shows up at Epcot Center 90 minutes after that park closes for the night.
After it closes? Okay.
Okay. Well, he did this because his estranged girlfriend, one Barbara Krause, worked as a security guard at that theme park. And so they had broken up like 6 months earlier. He shows up at the park, demands to meet Barbara. Can he talk with Barbara? And the security guard at the gate says no.
Can he not just drunk dial her like the rest of us do? Well, oh, my God. Oh, no cell phones. No cell phones.
Two other security guards eventually approach. So there's three security guards on one side of the turnstile. Al on the other side of the turnstile. He's not giving up. And he's really not giving up because he reaches into a nylon bag and pulls out a sawed-off shotgun.
Oh, what attraction would you like to go on, sir?
Well, that's the thing. He now fires three rounds at the first security guard who, again, I don't know how this happened, didn't get hit, but scampers off. He now takes the other two security guards hostage.
And what? I've never heard these things.
It proceeds to enter the park, makes it as far as the restrooms at Journey into Imagination, and takes them in there.
So he's not only in the middle of Future World, he's like on the far end. If he's made it all the way across Future World.
Yeah. He's still demanding to meet with Barbara. He did release his hostages at this point. And then this story really takes a tragic turn. He comes out of the bathroom with the shotgun. And he's now surrounded by Orange County, he's surrounded by Disney security. And what he's basically saying is, you're going to have to shoot me. He's a despondent guy and breaking up with his girlfriend. And Orange County and Disney won't shoot him. They're trying to talk him down. And so he turns the gun on himself. And this is what I'm saying. This is in a major city, in a Trenton or a Corpus Christi. These sorts of things, people who are sad, who are desperate, these sorts of things happen. But the difference is, like, for example, this past summer, when that three-year-old was found at the bottom of the pool at the Art of Animation, the internet goes nuts about where are the lifeguards, that sort of thing. Whereas back in August of 1977, a four-year-old actually climbs over the fence at the Magic Kingdom in front of Cinderella Castle and winds up drowning in the moat in front of... This is a summer day at the Magic Kingdom. There are tens of thousands of people passing back and forth, and nobody sees him. Not even his parents, who actually helped him over the fence.
They helped him go over the fence?
Yeah, in fact, that was initially Disney got sued by the family, and there was a $4 million settlement, because how could you allow this kid to drown? And then it came out during the settlement phase, it's like, you lifted your son over the fence to let him play on the grass. The last I can follow the court case, it went from a $4 million settlement to a $1.5 million settlement, because the parents were culpable. They'd actually put the kid over the fence. Look, bad things happen in big size cities every day, and bad things happen at Walt Disney World every day. I mean, I'm not saying this to be bleak, but there were a number of people who, in their mind, think, I'm feeling despondent, but I want to give my family that last Disney World vacation before I take myself out. That the number of people who jump off of the Contemporary.
Really?
Len, they actually have a tent at this point. When somebody will go up on the Contemporary and jump off, they have a tent that they can have assembled outside over the body inside of 5 minutes time, so they don't have to stop the monorail going back and forth to the park. It's happened enough times that there is an actual procedure. I mean, it's a tragedy. Anybody who takes their life and the impact that will happen to their families and that sort of thing. But at the same time, you're weighing that against the fact that if we stop the transportation system that's bringing tens of thousands of people to the park, we then have to figure out how to get them over there. And in the end, it's like, we need a way to do this. And they have their little metallic silver tent. And so, trust me, if you're ever going back and forth between the kingdom and happen to look outside the Contemporary and see a weird little silver tent down by the base of the building, that's not there to give away tickets.
All right, let's move on to a happier topic.
Now, speaking of which, we're talking about the monorail, the transportation system. It's been a tough 3 or 4 months for the monorail. I mean,
oh my God, yeah. I was there a couple weeks ago, and the monorail was not running during the day. They were busing people from the TTC to the Magic Kingdom.
We had the mechanical failure on October 10th. People were stranded between the Kingdom and the Contemporary for 2 hours. On November 18th, we had the monorail Coral rammed into a tug. One of the reasons Disney really didn't want to talk about this one is it was supposedly, this incident happened during a test of the new automated monorail system.
Oh, okay.
And then on December 16th, the monorail got stuck on the way to Epcot. In a lot of ways, for the people who work in transportation at Walt Disney World in general, this is kind of the last straw. Disney has really been focusing on the transportation aspect of Walt Disney World, whether it's the expansion of Buena Vista Drive as part of Disney Springs, that new feeder ramp that's coming off of 4, which the hope is that that will then take pressure off of World Drive and that sort of thing. Looking back to 2013, we saw the expansion of the Magic Kingdom Bus Depot, which now has 34 slots. Also, I really want to get this story out there about the significant change in wait time for the Disney bus system. We were talking about this earlier this year.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable. So we track how long on average you wait between bus arrivals at the Disney resorts. And it's something we've done since the very beginning of the unofficial guide. And every year we end up sampling somewhere between 500 and 1,500 bus routes. And that literally means watching between 500 and 1,500 buses come to the different resorts. And the interesting thing is that over the last couple of years, we've seen an average drop of a little bit more than 2 minutes in the average time it takes to get a bus at a resort. So Disney will tell you a bus comes approximately every 20 minutes. There were some years where we measured it and it was more like 22, which 2 minutes may not seem like a lot, but let's put that in perspective. This year, they're down to something around 16 minutes, a bus every 16 minutes. So that's a huge increase. If you think about Disney's bus fleet too, they own hundreds of buses.
That they do.
And again, then they transport hundreds of thousands of people a day between the resorts and the theme parks. It's probably got a bus system that is probably not comparable to Trenton, New Jersey, but like a fairly large town. I think Disney actually owns more buses than my town of Greensboro, North Carolina. And so to be able to improve the service level from 20 or 22 minutes on average arrival time to 16 minutes is a huge accomplishment. And something that I think that Disney doesn't get enough credit for. And that's definitely two things. One is they're buying more buses. But number two, there's an amazing amount of technology that's going into that to try and better estimate where crowds are and how to route the buses more efficiently to cut down on time. So things like try and make as few left turns as possible, because those take time. There's stuff that they're adapting that commercial delivery services have done for a long time, like UPS famously, do a lot to not make a left turn against traffic if they don't have to.
It's not just Disney buses on property. It's also buses that are transporting people who are off property, people who are staying along iDrive down toward Kissimmee, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the third-party bus parking lot is huge by the Magic Kingdom. It's like the size of Epcot's parking lot.
And they have to do the very thing you were talking about, that left turn. Specifically, they have to do a left turn off of World Drive onto Seven Seas Drive to get to that area out behind Ticket and Transportation Point to drop people off. And that's a real pinch point. that gums up cast members who are trying to get through World Drive to get back to backstage to get out on stage, or for that matter, people who are staying at the Contemporary or people who are staying at Wilderness Lodge and that chunk of property off behind Wilderness Lodge. We were talking about, what is it, the new waterfront bungalows that are under construction there. And sometime in the next 2 years or so, we're going to see them turn the key finally on that DVC that's supposed to be built on top of River Country.
Oh, you think that's coming next?
Oh, God, yeah. That supposedly, once you see the people complete the prep work, the construction team that's working on the bungalows, because right now they're just site clearing, you're then going to see a repeat of the previous. You'll see them sort of dam off the area so construction waste and, you know, that sort of thing isn't going out into Bay Lake.
Okay. Yeah.
Supposedly, just to take advantage of the equipment is on site, the teams are on site, we will see this year, supposedly, team discreetly move down to River Country, flatten it, take out all of the stuff that's there, and then you'll just see the teams, as they finish work on the bungalows, that they'll do the same thing. They'll just move down the shoreline, set up the same sort of construction dams, and at least do the initial site prep. Now,
wow.
Whether or not you see them immediately turn the key on that project, but it's just sort of the notion of, look, we have the teams here.
They have to move it a mile, exactly. Why wouldn't you do it?
And understanding that also means if you do build that resort, that's much more of a transportation issue.
Well, they've got boats, but let's stay on that for a second. So what is the DVC resort going to look like there? Is it going to be bungalows over water? Is it going to be a freestanding building? This is over where Fort Wilderness is.
Yeah, there's a couple of components of it. One is that you're going to have a pool area that does, in fact, pay tribute to River Country. You know, I know there's already the pool at Fort Wilderness that hint at or pay tribute to River Country, but this will have a smaller version of the Hoot and Holler and that sort of thing. And supposedly, this will be the pool area that they face into. This is a resort that's orientated toward the water, that will have a primo view of the nighttime water pageant. So that's coming. It's going to be reminiscent, sort of like if you took Fort Wilderness, like a Wilderness Lodge and the villas and the Pioneer Hall area, and created, we're only talking about a five-story building, because again, they don't want this to overwhelm the waterfront. So it'll have a commonality with the design language of those other three properties. But at the same time, you have to create parking, you have to create access roads, you have to also not disrupt the people who are using that back road for the buses that take Fort Wilderness guests out to the Kingdom, to Epcot, to Disney Springs and all that. And there's a lot coming. And just in the past year, what they've done in the parking lot for the Magic Kingdom, where you've seen since June, they shut down the Walt Disney World Speedway. And they still 2/3 of the old speedway left in place. The infield's still there, the outermost part of the track. And that supposedly will eventually also become additional parking for the Kingdom.
Yeah.
For now, I think they've reached a place where it's like, okay, let's hold this in reserve. But now they are looking around the outermost edges of this parking lot as ways to solve other problems. I mean, take, for instance, the old short takeoff and landing parking area.
This is it's at the right-hand side as you approach the
Magic
Kingdom?
Yeah, I mean, if you're driving up World Drive, headed to the Contemporary, it's off to the right. Usually these days it's filled with construction trailers. It's kind of a staging area. For example, when they were doing New Fantasyland, this is a lot of the off-site construction offices were there. But the new plan is that they're looking to turn this into the new off-site bus parking area. In fact, that there would be a little sort of transportation kiosk. You'd get off of your bus, and you'd then board a transportation system that would take you over to the TTC. And you could then disperse either Magic Kingdom or Epcot, and they'd also offer support bus systems for the studio and Animal Kingdom. You now take all the buses that used to go into that lot behind the Ticket and Transportation Center.
Right.
And they're no longer headed that way. So, again, that makes it that much easier to get onto Seven Seas Drive. It creates less of a traffic issue. I mean, it really does help in regard to this side of the property. But it also opens up a very interesting situation in that you now open up this giant chunk of property right along Seven Seas Lagoon.
This is the area, if you're at the TTC, mm-hmm. you're looking at the front of the TTC, it's the area to your right,
yeah.
behind the bathrooms. And how big is that in terms of acreage?
You're looking at 10 to 15 acres of land.
I'm looking this up on Google Maps, so you'll hear some typing as I do this.
It's All a right. good sized chunk of land. But at the same time, you are in this window where people in Walt Disney World Management have finally grown tired of dealing with the monorail breaking down constantly, with the fact that the TTC was basically built 71, you know, was upgraded in the early 80s to make room for the transportation link over to Epcot. There's now a thinking of what if we were to move the ticket and transportation center over into the old bus parking area.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You create a brand new transportation hub for the property that takes into consideration the crowd sizes of today. This was built, topped out in 82. There have been some upgrades since, mostly signage, but you create a brand new transportation hub there that's far more ADA compliant, takes into consideration the number of people who are on electric carts and strollers and that sort of thing. But you move it over into this old parking lot for the buses.
I'm measuring this area. It's about, so just the paved area alone is somewhere around, what's an acre? 45,000 square feet?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Just the paved area is an acre, but it's surrounded by land. Let's put it this way. It's at least as big as the Wilderness Lodge parking area and then some. So maybe it's 50% bigger than that. Okay, so it's at least as big as what you can get with the Wilderness Lodge. That's pretty huge. In comparison, you could fit the entire current TTC in that parking lot, by the way, with room to spare.
That is the plan. Now,
okay. All right.
Now, look at where the current ticket and transportation center is sitting. Look at how close you are to Seven Seas Lagoon.
You're right on it. In fact, it's the TTC is actually the thing that prevents the Polynesian from expanding east towards the TTC. So it actually is a hard stop. Oh, yeah, you could do that. You'd have a sliver. It'd be about a third the size of the... Oh, no, because then you have the whole thing above it.
Yes.
Oh, okay. The light goes on in Len's head.
Now.
This is the area on Topiary, where Topiary Lane is World Road. That area is at least as big as the Grand Floridian, all the way from the dock back to the business center and then all the way back to the Polynesian itself. It's at least the size of the Grand Floridian.
Okay. And remember that Disney had previously tried to build the Venetian on this spot and the Mediterranean. But the problem was, because the ticket and transportation center was in place, they were forced to get close down by the water, and they kept losing construction pilings in the area. It couldn't hold the weight of the resort.
They go back a little bit.
There you go.
Oh! The ground must be more stable where World Drive is, obviously, because it's a drive, and where the monorail goes, because those are pylons that have been sunk in and have been...
All I'm saying, Len, is watch this space. There's a chess game that's about to begin. Move one is off-site parking for buses put in the stall area. Move number two is a very much needed redo of the ticket and transportation system that will be coupled to the upgrade of the monorails with the new automated system. And then you have this giant piece of real estate that suddenly opens up right down by the water, Seven Seas Lagoon, the place where everybody wants to stay for the view of the kingdom.
Wow.
Here's the best part. If you actually do watch this space, coming up on the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World, I mean, I apologize for those of you who love the electric water pageant, but there's something new headed there.
Oh, really?
Remember how Disney filed those patents for the drone show, for the show where they're going to dangle characters from drones and have them perform? And ultimately, it was decided that real, and initially this show was designed for Epcot's World Showcase Lagoon, but Disney's lawyers and the safety people pushed back hard, because if these things went south, they were going to be, there's potential to spin out into a crowd and hurt somebody. From a safety point of view, I mean, it seems like a wonderful idea for a show, but from a safety point of view, it just did not work. The people in entertainment just didn't want to give up on this idea. And then eventually they begin to realize, now, wait a minute, what if we took this out to Seven Seas Lagoon and Bay Lake? Far bigger body of water, They're not up against a railing at Epcot watching this. There's 100 feet back on shore. There's a safety buffer. And so right now, the plan, I can't get an exact read on it because, again, there's a lot of technology that's being introduced with Rivers of Light about piloted vessels and that sort of thing that are really going to change how people perceive a Disney on water show. And trust me, when you guys get to see Rivers of Light and see some of the stuff they're going to try, it's going to be stunning. But for the 50th anniversary, let's give them a new waterfront show that will feature components on the water supplemented by these drone characters that will appear. And again, just do what they've done with the classic waterfront show. Just march it from resort to resort to resort. And people can go outside and see this spectacular new show that makes use of both drone technology as well as lit floats on the water.
Wow, nice.
Downside, folks, we're talking 2021, so don't put the lounge chair out on Seventh Lee's Lagoon just yet.
Fantastic. That's some interesting stuff. We started talking about transportation, and then we ended up talking about the new resorts and stuff that's going. That's very good.
Then we got the whole rest of this year to talk about, Len. I mean, between Frozen Forever After and New Soarin'. Lots of stuff to talk about in 2016, folks.
It'll be a fun year. Thanks very much, Jim. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. We are produced by Aaron Adams. Please go on to iTunes and Stitcher and rate our show and tell us what you would like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care.